you and I, for that matter, distrust the Espers is that they do represent something alien to us. Something that may eventually choke out the whole concept of life that we grew up with. You know, a couple weeks back in Sacramento, I dropped in at the university research lab to see what was going on. Incredible. The ordinary soldier would swear it was witch work.
End of side one.
Side two.
You know, a couple weeks back in Sacramento, I dropped in at the university research lab to see what was going on. Incredible. The ordinary soldier would swear it was witch work. It was certainly more weird than simply reading minds or moving objects by thinking at them. But to you and me, it's a shiny new marvel. We'll wallow in it. Now, why's that? Because the lab is scientific. Those men work with chemicals, electronics, subviral particles. That fits into the educated American's worldview. But the mystic unity of creation, no, not our cup of tea. The only way we can hope to achieve oneness is to renounce everything we've ever believed in. At your age or mine, Jimbo, a man is seldom ready to tear down his whole life and start from scratch. Maybe so. Mackenzie lost interest. The settlement was quite near now. He turned around to Captain Hulse, riding a few paces behind. "Here we go," he said. "Give my compliments to Lieutenant Colonel Yamaguchi and tell him he's in charge till we get back. If anything seems suspicious, he's to act at his own discretion." "Yes, sir," Hulse saluted and wheeled smartly about. There had been no practical need for Mackenzie to repeat what had long been agreed on, but he knew the value of ritual. He clicked his big sorrel gelding into a trot. At his back, he heard bugles sound orders and sergeants howl at their platoons. Spire kept pace. Mackenzie had insisted on bringing an extra man to the discussion. His own wits were probably no match for a high-level Esper, but Phil's might be. "Not that there's any question of diplomacy or whatever, I hope." To ease himself, he concentrated on what was real and present. Hoofbeats, the rise and fall of the saddle beneath him, the horse's muscles rippling between his thighs, the creak and jingle of his saber belt, the clean odor of the animal. And suddenly remembered this was the sort of trick the Espers recommended. None of their communities was walled, as most towns and every bossman station was. The officers turned off the highway and went down a street between colonnaded buildings. Side streets ran off in both directions. The settlement covered no great area, though, being composed of groups that lived together. Sodalities, or superfamilies, or whatever you wanted to call them. Some hostility toward the order and a great many dirty jokes stemmed from that practice. But Spire, who should know, said there was no more sexual swapping around than in the outside world. The idea was simply to get away from possessiveness, thee versus me, and to raise children as a part of a whole rather than an insular clan. The kids were out, staring round-eyed from the porticos, hundreds of them. They looked healthy and, underneath a natural fear of the invaders, happy enough. But pretty solemn, Mackenzie thought. And all in the same blue garb. Adults stood among them, expressionless. Everybody had come in from the fields as the regiment neared. The silence was like barricades. Mackenzie felt sweat begin to trickle down his ribs. When he emerged on the central square, he let out his breath in a near gasp. A fountain, the basin carved into a lotus, tinkled in the middle of the plaza. Flowering trees stood around it. The square was defined on three sides by massive buildings that must be for storage. On the fourth side rose a smaller temple-like structure with a graceful cupola, obviously headquarters and meeting house. On its lowest step were ranked half a dozen blue-robed men, five of them husky youths. The sixth was middle-aged, the yang and yin on his breast. His features, ordinary in themselves, held an implacable calm. Mackenzie and Spire drew rein. The colonel flipped a soft salute. "Professor Gaines, I'm Mackenzie. Here's Major Spire." He swore at himself for being so awkward about it and wondered what to do with his hands. The young fellows he understood, more or less. They watched him with badly concealed hostility. But he had some trouble meeting Gaines' eyes. The settlement leader inclined his head. "Welcome, gentlemen. Won't you come in?" Mackenzie dismounted, hitched his horse to a post, and removed his helmet. His worn reddish-brown uniform felt shabbier yet in these surroundings.
"Thanks. I'll have to make this quick."
"To be sure. Follow me, please." Stiff-backed, the young men trailed their elders through an entry chamber and down a short hall. Spire looked around at the mosaics.
"Why, this is lovely," he murmured.
"Thank you," said Gaines. "Here's my office." He opened a door of superbly grained walnut and gestured the visitors through. When he closed it behind himself, the acolytes waited outside. The room was austere, whitewashed walls enclosing little more than a desk, a shelf of books, and some backless chairs. A window opened on a garden. Gaines sat down. Mackenzie and Spire followed suit, uncomfortable on this furniture.
"We better get right to business," the colonel blurted.
Gaines said nothing. At last, Mackenzie must plow ahead.
"Here's the situation. Our force is to occupy Calistoga, with detachments on either side of the hills. That way we'll control both the Napa Valley and the Valley of the Moon, from the northern ends, at least. The best place to station our eastern wing is here. We plan to establish a fortified camp in the field yonder. I'm sorry about the damage to your crops, but you'll be compensated once the proper government has been restored. And food, medicine. You understand this army has to requisition such items, but we won't let anybody suffer undue hardship, and we'll give receipts. As a precaution, we'll need to quarter a few men in this community to sort of keep an eye on things. They'll interfere as little as possible. Okay?
The charter of the order guarantees exemption from military requirements, Gaines answered evenly. In fact, no armed man is supposed to cross the boundary of any land held by an Esper settlement. I cannot be party to a violation of the law, Colonel.
If you want to split legal hairs, philosopher, Spire said, then I'll remind you that both Fallon and Judge Brodsky have declared martial law. Ordinary rules are suspended.
Gaines smiled. Since only one government can be legitimate, he said, the proclamations of the other are necessarily null and void. To a disinterested observer, it would appear that Judge Fallon's title is the stronger, especially when his side controls a large continuous area rather than some scattered bostoms.
Not anymore, it doesn't, Mackenzie snapped.
Spire gestured him back. Perhaps you haven't followed the developments of the last few weeks, philosopher, he said. Allow me to recapitulate. The Sierra Command stole a march on the Fallonites and came down out of the mountains. There was almost nothing left in the middle part of California to oppose us, so we took over rapidly. By occupying Sacramento, we control river and rail traffic. Our bases extend south below Bakersfield, with Yosemite and Kings Canyon not far away to provide sites for extremely strong positions. When we've consolidated this northern end of our gains, the Fallonite forces around Redding will be trapped between us and the powerful boss men who still hold out in the Trinity, Shasta, and Lassen regions. The very fact of our being here has forced the enemy to evacuate the Columbia Valley,
so that San Francisco may be defended. It's an open question which side today has the last word in the larger territory.
What about the army that went into the Sierra against you? Gaines inquired shrewdly. Have you contained them?
Mackenzie scowled. No. That's no secret. They got out through the motherlode country and went around us. They're down in Los Angeles and San Diego now.
A formidable host. Do you expect to stand them off indefinitely?
We're going to make a hell of a good try, Mackenzie said. Where we are, we've got the advantage of interior communications, and most of the freeholders are glad to slip us a word about whatever they observe. We can concentrate at any point the enemy starts to attack.
Pity that this rich land must also be torn apart by war.
Yeah, isn't it?
Our strategic objective is obvious enough, Spire said. We have cut enemy communications across the middle, except by sea, which is not very satisfactory for troops operating far inland. We deny him access to a good part of his food and manufactured supplies, and most especially to the bulk of his fuel alcohol. The backbone of our side is the Bostoms, which are almost self-contained economic and social units. Before long, they'll be in better shape than the rootless army they face. I think Judge Brodsky will be back in San Francisco before fall.
If your plans succeed, Gaines said.
That's our worry, Mackenzie leaned forward, one fist doubled on his knee. Okay, philosopher. I know you'd rather see Fallon come out on top, but I expect you've got more sense than to sign up in a lost cause. Will you cooperate with us?
The Order takes no part in political affairs, Colonel, except when its own existence is endangered.
Oh, pipe down. By cooperate, I don't mean anything but keeping out from under our feet.
I'm afraid that would still count as cooperation. We cannot have military establishments on our lands.
Mackenzie stared at Gaines' face, which had set into granite lines, and wondered if he had heard aright.
Are you ordering us off? A stranger asked with his voice.
Yes, the philosopher said.
With our artillery zeroed in on your town?
Would you really shell women and children, Colonel?
Oh, Nora.
We don't need to. Our men can walk right in.
Against PSI blasts? I beg you not to have those poor boys destroyed.
Gaines paused, then. I might also point out that by losing your regiment, you imperil your whole cause.
You are free to march around our holdings and proceed to Calistoga.
Leaving a Fallonite nest at my back, spang across my communications southward? The teeth grated together in Mackenzie's mouth.
Gaines rose. The discussion is at an end, gentlemen, he said. You have 1 hour to get off our lands.
Mackenzie and Spire stood up, too. We're not done yet, the major said. Sweat studded his forehead and a long nose. I want to make some further explanations.
Gaines crossed the room and opened the door.
Show these gentlemen out, he said to the 5 acolytes.
No, by God, Mackenzie shouted. He clapped a hand to his sidearm.
Inform the adepts, Gaines said. One of the young men turned. Mackenzie heard the slap-slap of his sandals running down the hall. Gaines nodded. I think you had better go, he said.
Spire grew rigid. His eyes shut. They flew open and he breathed,
Inform the adepts?
Mackenzie saw the stiffness break in Gaines' countenance. There was no time for more than a second's bewilderment. His body acted for him. The gun clanked from his holster simultaneously with Spire's.
Get that messenger, Jimbo, the major rapped.
I'll keep these birds covered. As he plunged forward, Mackenzie found himself worrying about the regimental honor. Was it right to open hostilities when you had come on a parley? But Gaines had cut the talk off himself.
Stop him!
Gaines yelled. The four remaining acolytes sprang into motion. Two of them barred the doorway. The other two moved in on either side.
Hold it or I'll shoot, Spire cried,
and was ignored. Mackenzie couldn't bring himself to fire on unarmed men. He gave the youngster before him the pistol barrel in his teeth. Bloody-faced, the Esper lurched back. Mackenzie stiff-armed the one coming in from the left. The third tried to fill the doorway. Mackenzie put a foot behind his ankles and pushed. As he went down, Mackenzie kicked him in the temple, hard enough to stun, and jumped over him. The fourth was on his back. Mackenzie writhed about to face the man. Those arms that hugged him, pinioning his gun, were bare strong. Mackenzie put the butt of his free left hand under the fellow's nose and pushed. The acolyte must let go. Mackenzie gave him a knee in the stomach, whirled, and ran. There was not much further commotion behind him. Phil must have them under control. Mackenzie pelted along the hall into the entry chamber. Where had that goddamn runner gone? He looked out the open entrance, onto the square. Sunlight hurt his eyes. His breath came in painful gulps. There was a stitch in his side. Yeah, he was getting old. Blue robes fluttered from a street. Mackenzie recognized the messenger. The youth pointed at this building. A gabble of his words drifted faintly through Mackenzie's pulse. There were 7 or 8 men with him, older men, nothing to mark their clothes. But Mackenzie knew a high-ranking officer when he saw one. The acolyte was dismissed. Those whom he had summoned crossed the square with long strides. Terror knotted Mackenzie's bowels. He put it down. A catamount didn't stampede, even from somebody who could turn him inside out with a look. He could do nothing about the wretchedness that followed, though. If they clobber me, so much the better. I won't lie awake nights wondering how Laura is. The adepts were almost to the steps. Mackenzie trod forth. He swept his revolver in an arc.
Halt!
His voice sounded tiny in the stillness that brooded over the town. They jarred to a stop and stood there in a group. He saw them enforce a cat-like relaxation, and their faces became blank visors. None spoke. Finally, Mackenzie was unable to keep silent.
This place is hereby occupied under the laws of war, he said. Go back to your quarters.
What have you done with our leader? Asked a tall man.
His voice was even but deeply resonant.
Read my mind and find out, Mackenzie jibed.
No, you're being childish.
He's okay, long as he keeps his nose clean. You too. Beat it.
We do not wish to pervert psionics to violence, said the tall man. Please do not force us.
Your chief sent for you before we'd done anything, Mackenzie retorted. Looks like violence was what he had in mind. On your way.
The Espers exchanged glances. The tall man nodded. His companions walked slowly off.
I would like to see Philosopher Gaines, the tall man said.
You will pretty soon.
Am I to understand that he is being held a prisoner?
Understand what you like.
The other Espers were rounding the corner of the building.
I don't want to shoot. Go on back before I have to.
An impasse of sorts, the tall man said. Neither of us wishes to injure one whom he considers defenseless. Allow me to conduct you off these grounds.
Mackenzie wet his lips. Weather had chapped them rough.
If you can put a hex on me, go ahead, he challenged. Otherwise, scram.
Well, I shall not hinder you from rejoining your men. It seems the easiest way of getting you to leave. But I most solemnly warn that any armed force which tries to enter will be annihilated.
Guess I'd better go get the boys at that. Phil can't mount guard on those guys forever. The tall man went over to the hitching post.
Which of these horses is yours? He asked blandly.
Almighty eager to get rid of me, isn't he? Holy hellfire, there must be a rear door.
Mackenzie spun on his heel. The Esper shouted. Mackenzie dashed back through the entry chamber. His boots threw echoes at him. No, not to the left. There's only the office that way. Right, around this corner.
A long hall stretched before him. A stairway curved from the middle. The other Espers were already on it.
Halt! Mackenzie called. Stop or I'll shoot!
The two men in the lead sped onward. The rest turned and headed down again toward him. He fired with care, to disable rather than kill. The hall reverberated with the explosions. One after another, they dropped, a bullet in leg or hip or shoulder. With such small targets, Mackenzie missed some shots. As the tall man, the last of them, closed in from behind, the hammer clicked on an empty chamber. Mackenzie drew his saber and gave him the flat of it alongside the head. The Esper lurched. Mackenzie got past and bounded up the stair. It wound like something in a nightmare. He thought his heart was going to go to pieces. At the end, an iron door opened on a landing. One man was fumbling with the lock. The other blue robe attacked. Mackenzie stuck his sword between the Esper's legs. As his opponent stumbled, the colonel threw a left hook to the jaw. The man sagged against the wall. Mackenzie grabbed the robe of the other and hurled him to the floor. Get out, he rattled. They pulled themselves together and glared at him. He thrust air with his blade. From now on, I aim to kill, he said. Get help, Dave, said the one who had been opening the door. I'll watch him.
The other went unevenly down the stairs. The first man stood out of saber reach.
Do you want to be destroyed? He asked.
Mackenzie turned the knob at his back, but the door was still locked.
I don't think you can do it, he said. Not without what's here.
The Esper struggled for self-control. They waited through minutes that stretched. Then a noise began below. The Esper pointed.
We have nothing but agricultural implements, he said.
But you have only that blade.
Will you surrender?
Mackenzie spat on the floor. The Esper went on down. Presently, the attackers came into view. There might be 100, judging from the hubbub behind them, but because of the curve, Mackenzie could see no more than 10 or 15. Burly field hands, their robes tucked high and sharp tools aloft. The landing was too wide for defense. He advanced to the stairway, where they could only come at him 2 at a time. A couple of saw-toothed hay knives led the assault. Mackenzie parried one blow and chopped. His edge went into meat and struck bone. Blood ran out, impossibly red, even in the dim light here. The man fell to all fours with a shriek. Mackenzie dodged a cut from the companion. Metal clashed on metal. The weapons locked. Mackenzie's arm was forced back. He looked into a broad, suntanned face. The side of his hand smote the young man's larynx. The Esper fell against the one behind, and they went down together. It took a while to clear the tangle and resume action. A pitchfork thrust for the colonel's belly. He managed to grab it with his left hand, divert the tines, and chop at the fingers on the shaft. A scythe gashed his right side. He saw his own blood, but wasn't aware of pain. A flesh wound, no more. He swept his saber back and forth, the forefront retreating from its whistling menace. But God, my knees are like rubber. I can't hold out another 5 minutes. A bugle sounded. There was a spatter of gunfire. The mob on the staircase congealed. Someone screamed. Hoofs banged across the ground floor. A voice rasped,
"Hold everything there! Drop those weapons and come on down! First man tries anything gets shot!"
Mackenzie leaned on his saber and fought for air. He hardly noticed the Espers melt away. When he felt a little better, he went to one of the small windows and looked out. Horsemen were in the plaza.
not yet in sight, but nearing. He heard infantry. Spire arrived, followed by a sergeant of engineers and several privates. The major hurried to Mackenzie. "You okay, Jimbo? You've been hurt?"
"A scratch," Mackenzie said.
He was getting back his strength, though no sense of victory accompanied it, only the knowledge of aloneness. The injury began to sting.
"Not worth a fuss. Look. Yes, I suppose you'll live. Okay, men, get that door open."
The engineers took forth their tools and assailed the lock with a vigor that must spring half from fear.
"How'd you guys show up so soon?" Mackenzie asked.
"I thought there'd be trouble," Spire said, "so when I heard shots, I jumped through the window and ran around to my horse. That was just before those clodhoppers attacked you. I saw them gathering as I rode out. Our cavalry got in almost at once, of course, and the dog faces weren't far behind."
"Any resistance?"
"No, not after we fired a few rounds in the air." Spire glanced outside. "We're in full possession now." Mackenzie regarded the door.
"Well," he said, "I feel better about our having pulled guns on them in the office. Looks like their adepts really depend on plain old weapons, huh? And Esper communities aren't supposed to have arms. Their charters say so." "That was a damn good guess of yours, Phil. How'd you do it?"
"I sort of wondered why the chief had to send a runner to fetch guys that claim to be telepaths."
"There we go."
The lock jingled apart. The sergeant opened the door. Mackenzie and Spire went into the great room under the dome. They walked around for a long time, wordless, among shapes of metal and less identifiable substances. Nothing was familiar. Mackenzie paused at last before a helix which projected from a transparent cube. Formless darknesses swirled within the box, sparked as if with tiny stars. "I figured maybe the Espers had found a cache of old-time stuff from just before the hell bombs," he said in a muffled voice. "Ultra-secret weapons that never got a chance to be used. But this doesn't look like it."
"Think so?"
"No," Spire said. "Doesn't look to me as if these things were made by human beings at all."
"But do you not understand? They occupied a settlement. That proves to the world that Espers are not invulnerable. And to complete the catastrophe, they seized its arsenal." "Have no fears about that. No untrained person can activate those instruments. The circuits are locked except in the presence of certain encephalic rhythms which result from conditioning. That same conditioning makes it impossible for the so-called adepts to reveal any of their knowledge to the uninitiated, no matter what may be done to them." "Yes, I know that much. But it is not what I had in mind. What frightens me is the fact that the revelation will spread. Everyone will know the Esper adepts do not plumb unknown depths of the psyche after all, but merely have access to an advanced physical science. Not only will this lift rebel spirits, but worse, it will cause many, perhaps most of the Order's members to break away in disillusionment. Not all at once. News travels slowly under present conditions. Also, Mreer, you underestimate the ability of the human mind to ignore data which conflict with cherished beliefs. But, well, let us assume the worst. Let us suppose that faith is lost and the order disintegrates. That will be a serious setback to the plan, but not a fatal one. Psionics was merely one bit of folklore we found potent enough to serve as the motivator of a new orientation toward life. There are others. For example, the widespread belief in magic among the less educated classes. We can begin again on a different basis, if we must. The exact form of the creed is not important. It is only scaffolding for the real structure. A communal, anti-materialistic social group to which more and more people will turn for sheer lack of anything else, as the coming empire breaks up. In the end, the new culture can and will discard whatever superstitions gave it the initial impetus. 100-year setback at least. True, it would be much more difficult to introduce a radical alien element now, when the autochthonous society has developed strong institutions of its own, than it was in the past. I merely wish to reassure you that the task is not impossible. I do not actually propose to let matters go that far. The Espers can be salvaged. How? We must intervene directly. Has that been computed as being unavoidable? Yes, the Matrix yields an unambiguous answer. I do not like it any better than you, but direct action occurs oftener than we tell neophytes in the schools. The most elegant procedure would, of course, be to establish such initial conditions in a society that its evolution along desired lines becomes automatic. Furthermore, that would let us close our minds to the distressing fact of our own blood guilt. Unfortunately, the great science does not extend down to the details of day-to-day practicality. In the present instance, we shall help to smash the reactionaries. The government will then proceed so harshly against its conquered opponents that many of those who accept the story about what was found at St. Helena will not live to spread the tale. The rest, well, they will be discredited by their own defeat. Admittedly, the story will linger for lifetimes, whispered here and there. But what of that? Those who believe in the way will, as a rule, simply be strengthened in their faith by the very process of denying such ugly rumors. As more and more persons, common citizens as well as espers, reject materialism, the legend will seem more and more fantastic. It will seem obvious that certain ancients invented the tale to account for a fact that they, in their ignorance, were unable to comprehend. I see. You are not happy here, are you, Maria? I cannot quite say. Everything is so distorted. Be glad you are not sent to one of the really alien planets. I might almost prefer that. There would be a hostile environment to think about. One could forget how far it is to home. 3 years' travel. You say that so glibly, as if 3 shipboard years were not equal to 50 in cosmic time, as if we could expect a relief vessel daily, not once in a century. And as if the region that our ships have explored amounts to one chip out of this one galaxy. That region will grow until someday it engulfs the galaxy. Yes, 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 I know. Why do you think I chose to become a psychodynamician? Why am I here learning how to meddle with the destiny of a world where I do not belong? Create the union of sentient beings, each member species a step toward life's mastery of the universe. Brave slogan, but in practice, it seems, only a chosen few races are to be allowed the freedom of that universe. Not so, Mrir. Consider these ones with whom we are, as you say, meddling. Consider what use they made of nuclear energy when they had it. At the rate they are going, they will have it again within a century or two. Not long after that, they will be building spaceships. Even granted that time lag attenuates the effects of interstellar contact, those effects are cumulative. So, do you wish such a band of carnivores turned loose on the galaxy? No. Let them become inwardly civilized first. Then we shall see if they can be trusted. If not, they will at least be happy on their own planet, in a mode of life designed for them by the great science. Remember, they have an immemorial aspiration toward peace on Earth, but that is something they will never achieve by themselves. I do not pretend to be a very good person, Muir. Yet this work that we are doing makes me feel not altogether useless in the cosmos.
Promotion was fast that year, casualties being so high. Captain Thomas Danielis was raised to major for his conspicuous part in putting down the revolt of the Los Angeles city men. Soon after occurred the Battle of Maricopa, when the Loyalists failed bloodily to break the stranglehold of the Sierran rebels on the San Joaquin Valley, and he was breveted Lieutenant Colonel. The army was ordered northward and moved warily under the coast ranges, half expecting attack from the east. But the Brodskyites seemed too busy consolidating their latest gains. The trouble came from guerrillas and the hedgehog resistance of bossman stations. After one particularly stiff clash, they stopped near Pinnacles for a breather. Danielis made his way through camp, where tents stood in tight rows between the guns and men lay about dozing, talking, gambling, staring at the blank blue sky. The air was hot, pungent with cook fire smoke, horses, mules, dung, sweat, boot oil. The green of the hills that lifted around the site was dulling toward summer brown. He was idle until time for the conference the general had called, but restlessness drove him. By now I'm a father, he thought, and I've never seen my kid. At that, I'm lucky, he reminded himself. I've got my life and limbs. He remembered Jacobson dying in his arms at Maricopa. You wouldn't have thought the human body could hold so much blood. Though maybe one was no longer human when the pain was so great that one could do nothing but shriek until the darkness came. And I used to think war was glamorous. Hunger, thirst, exhaustion, terror, mutilation, death, and forever the sameness. Boredom grinding you down to an ox. I've had it. I'm going into business after the war. Economic integration as the boss man's system breaks up. Yes, there'll be a lot of ways for a man to get ahead. But decently, without a weapon in his hand. Danielis realized he was repeating thoughts that were months old. What the hell else was there to think about, though? The large tent where prisoners were interrogated lay near his path. A couple of privates were conducting a man inside. The fellow was blonde, burly, and sullen. He wore a sergeant's stripes, but otherwise his only item of uniform was the badge of Warden Echeverry, boss man in this part of the coastal mountains. A lumberjack in peacetime, Danielis guessed from the look of him. A soldier in a private army whenever the interests of Echeverry were threatened, captured in yesterday's engagement. On impulse, Danielis followed. He got into the tent as Captain Lambert, chubby behind a portable desk, finished the preliminaries and blinked in the sudden gloom. Oh, the intelligence officer started to rise. Yes, sir. At ease, Danielis said. Just thought I'd listen in. Well, I'll try to put on a good show for you. Lambert reseated himself and looked at the prisoner, who stood with hunched shoulders and widespread legs between his guards. Now, Sergeant, we'd like to know a few things. I don't have anything to say except name, rank, and hometown, the man growled. You got those. That's questionable. You aren't a foreign soldier. You're in rebellion against the government of your own country. The hell I am. I'm an Echeverry man. So what? So my judge is whoever Echeverry says. He says Brodsky. That makes you the rebel. The law's been changed. Your mucking Fallon got no right to change any laws, especially part of the Constitution. I'm no hill runner, Captain. I went to school some, and every year our warden reads his people the Constitution. Times have changed since it was drawn, Lambert said, his tone sharpened. But I'm not going to argue with you. How many riflemen and how many archers in your company? Silence. We can make things a lot easier for you, Lambert said. I'm not asking you to do anything treasonable. All I want is to confirm some information I've already got. The man shook his head angrily. Lambert gestured.
One of the privates stepped behind the captive, took his arm, and twisted a little. Echeverry wouldn't do that to me, he said through white lips. Of course not, Lambert said. You're his man. Think I want to be just a number on some list in Frisco? Damn right I'm my boss man's man. Lambert gestured again. The private twisted harder. Huh! Hold on there, Daniela sparked. Stop that! The private let go, looking surprised. The prisoner drew a sobbing breath. I'm amazed at you, Captain Lambert, Daniela said. He felt his own face reddening. If this has been your usual practice, there's going to be a court-martial. No, sir, Lambert said in a small voice. Honest. Only, they don't talk. Hardly any of them. What am I supposed to do? Follow the rules of war. With rebels? Take that man away, Danielis ordered. The privates made haste to do so. Sorry, sir, Lambert muttered. I guess I've lost too many buddies. I hate to lose more, simply for lack of information. Me too. A compassion rose in Danielis. He sat down on the table edge and began to roll a cigarette. But you see, we aren't in a regular war. And so, by a curious paradox, we have to follow the conventions more carefully than ever before. I don't quite understand, sir. Danielis finished the cigarette and gave it to Lambert. Olive branch or something. He started another for himself. The rebels aren't rebels by their own lights, he said. They're being loyal to a tradition that we're trying to curb, eventually to destroy. Let's face it, the average boss man is a fairly good leader. He may be descended from some thug who grabbed power by strong-arm methods during the chaos, but by now his family's integrated itself with the region he rules. He knows it, and its people inside out. He's there in the flesh, a symbol of the community and its achievements, its folkways and essential independence. If you're in trouble, you don't have to work through some impersonal bureaucracy. You go direct to your boss man. His duties are as clearly defined as your own, and a good deal more demanding to balance his privileges. He leads you in battle and in the ceremonies that give color and meaning to life. Your fathers and his have worked and played together for 200 or 300 years. The land is alive with the memories of them. You and he belong. Well, that has to be swept away so we can go on to a higher level. But we won't reach that level by alienating everyone. We're not a conquering army. We're more like the householder guard putting down a riot in some city. The opposition is part and parcel of our own society. Lambert struck a match for him. He inhaled and finished. On a practical plane, I might also remind you, Captain, that the federal armed forces, Fallonite and Brodskyite together, are none too large. Little more than a cadre, in fact. We're a bunch of younger sons, countrymen who failed, poor city men, adventurers, people who look to their regiment for that sense of wholeness they've grown up to expect and can't find in civilian life. You're too deep for me, sir, I'm afraid, Lambert said. Never mind, Daniela sighed. Just bear in mind there are a good many more fighting men outside the opposing armies than in. If the boss men could establish a unified command, that'd be the end of the Fallon government. Luckily, there's too much provincial pride and too much geography between them for this to happen, unless we outrage them beyond endurance. What we want the ordinary freeholder and even the ordinary boss man to think is, well, those Fallonites aren't such bad guys, and if I keep on the right side of them, I don't stand to lose much. And should even be able to gain something at the expense of those who fight them to a finish. You see? Yes, I guess so. You're a smart fellow, Lambert. You don't have to beat information out of prisoners. Trick it out. I'll try, sir. Good. Danielis glanced at the watch that had been given him as per tradition, together with a sidearm, when he was first commissioned. Such items were much too expensive for the common man. They had not been so in the age of mass production, and perhaps in the coming age. I have to go. See you around.
He left the tent feeling somewhat more cheerful than before. No doubt I'm a natural-born preacher, he admitted, and I never could quite join in the horseplay at mess, and a lot of jokes go completely by me. But if I can get even a few ideas across where they count, that's pleasure enough. A strain of music came to him. Some men and a banjo under a tree, and he found himself whistling along. It was good that this much morale remained after Maricopa and a northward march whose purpose had not been divulged to anybody. The conference tent was big enough to be called a pavilion. Two sentries stood at the entrance. Danielis was nearly the last to arrive and found himself at the end of the table opposite Brigadier General Perez. Smoke hazed the air and there was a muted buzz of conversation, but faces were taut. When the blue-robed figure with a yang and yin on the breast entered, silence fell like a curtain. Danielis was astonished to recognize Philosopher Woodworth. He'd last seen the man in Los Angeles and assumed he would stay at the Esper Center there. Must have come here by special conveyance, under special orders. Perez introduced him. Both remained standing under the eyes of the officers. I have some important news for you, gentlemen, Perez said most quietly. You may consider it an honor to be here. It means that in my judgment, you can be trusted. First, to keep absolute silence about what you are going to hear. And second, to execute a vital operation of extreme difficulty. Danielis was made shockingly aware that several men were not present whose rank indicated they should be. I repeat, Perez said. Any breach of secrecy, and the whole plan is ruined. In that case, the war will drag on for months or years. You know how bad our position is. You also know it will grow still worse as our stocks of those supplies the enemy now denies us are consumed. We could even be beaten. I'm not defeatist to say that, only realistic. We could lose the war. On the other hand, if this new scheme pans out, we may break the enemy's back this very month. He paused to let that sink in before continuing. The plan was worked out by GHQ in conjunction with Esper Central in San Francisco some weeks ago. It's the reason we are heading north. He let the gasp subside that ran through the stifling air. Yes, you know that the Esper Order is neutral in political disputes. But you also know that it defends itself when attacked. And you probably know that an attack was made on it by the rebels. They seized the Napa Valley settlement and have been spreading malicious rumors about the order since then. Would you like to comment on that, Philosopher Woodworth? The man in blue nodded and said coolly, We've our own way of finding out things. Intelligence service, you might say. So I can give y'all a report of the facts. St. Helena was assaulted at a time when most of its adepts were away, helping a new community get started out in Montana. How did they travel so fast, Danielis wondered. Teleport or what? I don't know myself if the enemy knew about that or were just lucky. Anyhow, when the two or three adepts that were left came and warned them off, fighting broke out and the adepts were killed before they could act. He smiled. We don't claim to be immortal, except the way every living thing is immortal, nor infallible either. So now St. Helena's occupied. We don't figure to take any immediate steps about that because a lot of people in the community might get hurt. As for the yarns the enemy command's been handing out, well,
I reckon I'd do the same if I had a chance like that. Everybody knows an adept can do things that nobody else can. Troops that realize they've done wrong to the order are going to be scared of supernatural revenge. You're educated men here, and know there's nothing supernatural involved. Just a way to use the powers latent in most of us. You also know the order doesn't believe in revenge. But the ordinary foot soldier doesn't think your way. His officers have got to restore his spirit somehow. So they fake some equipment and tell him that's what the adepts were really using. An advanced technology, sure, but only a set of machines that can be put out of action if you're brave. Same as any other machine. That's what happened. Still, it is a threat to the order. And we can't let an attack on our people go unpunished either. So Esper Central has decided to help out your side. The sooner this war is over, the better for everybody. A sigh gusted around the table and a few exultant oaths. The hair stirred on Daniela's neck. Perez lifted a hand. Not too fast, please, the general said. The adepts are not going to go around blasting your opponents for you. It was one hell of a tough decision for them to do as much as they agreed to. I understand that the personal development of every Esper will be set back many years by this much violence. They're making a big sacrifice. By their charter, they can use psionics to defend an establishment against attack. Okay, an assault on San Francisco will be construed as one on Central, their world headquarters. The realization of what was to come was blinding to Danielis. He scarcely heard Perez's carefully dry continuation. Let's review the strategic picture. By now, the enemy holds more than half of California, all of Oregon and Idaho, and a good deal of Washington. We, this army, we're using the last land access to San Francisco that we've got. The enemy hasn't tried to pinch that off yet, because the troops we pulled out of the north, those that aren't in the field at present, make a strong city garrison that'd sally out. He's collecting too much profit elsewhere to accept the cost. Nor can he invest the city with any hope of success. We still hold Puget Sound and the Southern California ports. Our ships bring in ample food and munitions. His own sea power is much inferior to ours, chiefly schooners donated by coastal bossmen operating out of Portland. He might overwhelm an occasional convoy, but he hasn't tried that so far because it isn't worth his trouble. There would be others more heavily escorted. And, of course, he can't enter the bay with artillery and rocket emplacements on both sides of the Golden Gate. No, about all he can do is maintain some water communication with Hawaii and Alaska. Nevertheless, his ultimate object is San Francisco. It has to be the seat of government and industry, the heart of the nation. Well then, here's the plan. Our army is to engage the Sierra Command and its militia auxiliaries again, striking out of San Jose. That's a perfectly logical maneuver. Successful, it would cut his California forces in two. We know, in fact, that he is already concentrating men in anticipation of precisely such an attempt. We aren't going to succeed. We'll give him a good stiff battle and be thrown back. That's the hardest part, to feign a serious defeat, even convincing our own troops and still maintain good order. We'll have a lot of details to thresh out about that. We'll retreat northward, up the peninsula toward Frisco. The enemy is bound to pursue. It will look like a God-given chance to destroy us and get to the city walls. When he is well into the peninsula, with the ocean on his left and the bay on his right, We will outflank him and attack from the rear. The Esper adepts will be there to help. Suddenly, he'll be caught between us and the capital's land defenses. What the adepts don't wipe out, we will. Nothing will remain of the Sierra Command but a few garrisons. The rest of the war will be a mopping-up operation. It's a brilliant piece of strategy. Like all such, it's damned difficult to execute. Are you prepared to do the job? Danielis didn't raise his voice with the others. He was thinking too hard of Laura. Northward and to the right, there was some fighting. Cannon spoke occasionally, or a drum fire of rifles. Smoke lay thin over the grass, and the wind